And now it's our great pleasure to welcome John Hall and introduce John Hall. He's a real pioneer in this field. He started the project on measuring progress of societies in 2005, and he moved from the Australian Bureau of Statistics to the OECD to make this project work. And in very short time, he managed to organize a big event in Istanbul, which resulted in the Istanbul Declaration in 2007. So it proved also that there's a real need for a dialogue on these issues. And John Hall is a real passionate person in this field. We really have to be grateful because he just arrived yesterday evening from Paris, and this afternoon, 3 o'clock, he has to go to Australia. So I hope John won't be affected too much by the jet lag, but we have to be really grateful that he take the burden to share this moment with us. John has degrees in mathematics and statistics, and master degrees in public service administration from the Australian and the New Zealand schools of government. And John not only worked in Australia and UK, but also in Zambia for the World Food Programme. So he has really a broad perspective, and we're very happy that he's here to present the project. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you very much, Hans. Thank you, everyone, for coming and for inviting me here. Hans says I'm passionate. I think I'm perhaps crazy. But so I'm a little bit tired, but it's really nice to be back in Bangkok. I like Thailand very much. So let me talk to you about this global project that we're working on. First of all, why is it so important that we have the indicators for a society? Well, really because we are what we measure. We value what we measure, and we get what we measure. And that's what we really find. If the things we value are the things we measure, and if we're measuring the wrong things, then as a society, we're valuing the wrong things. We only manage the things we measure. It's just what we're like as people. Someone called Hazel Henderson, who's an academic who's written books on this from the US, talks about statistical indicators. Thanks. Statistical indicators as being like the DNA codes of a society. They're the things that embody our genetics, that determine what we do. So it's really, really important we have the right measures for any society. We are what we measure. As I said, there's three things you can take away from this talk of mine this morning. These are the three points. We are what we measure, we value what we measure, and we get what we measure. And if we're measuring the wrong things, then that's what we get. And perhaps that's what we've seen with the crisis. We were measuring greed, and that's what we got. So we need to measure the right things. Can't say that often enough. I'm going to talk a bit about what the global project is and why we have a global project out of the OECD. I'll talk a little bit about frameworks for indicators, because one of the first things I think you'll need to do in Thailand will be for the people who are running this project, designing the index, to try and decide what progress looks like for Thailand. And it's an important conversation, but it's not an easy one. So I'll point you to a new framework that we're thinking about, which is a way to begin that conversation. And I'll talk a little bit about objective and subjective measures. That's measures of happiness and life satisfaction compared to the more traditional statistics of things like GDP and life expectancy. So what's the problem at the moment? Well, for 60 years, we've been measuring this thing called gross domestic product. It's simply a measure of how busy we are as a society, of how much money is changing hands. It was never developed to be a measure of progress. And I'm sure Professor Stiglitz will be talking about this in August. GDP was developed as a measure to manage the Great Depression in the US and then the wartime economy. It's just a measure of how much money changes hands. But somehow, I don't know how, by accident, over the last 30, 40 years, GDP has become seen as a measure of progress, and it was never meant to be, but that's just what happened. People started using it in that way, and other people started using it, and so on. So there was a feeling around the world that if GDP was going up, then everything was fine in our society. And it's only really in the last 10 years, I'd say, that people have realized what's happening. Economists have suddenly said, well, that's wrong. It was never meant to be used in this way, but that's what's happening. That's how politicians and the press have used GDP. So we need to say no, GDP is not a measure of progress. It's one measure of progress perhaps, but there's many other things we need to think about. And including the OECD now. Our Secretary General is saying we need to measure welfare, how well people are, not just how busy we are, how much stuff we're producing and paying for. There's a speech by Kennedy. I don't think there's time to show it now, but I encourage you all, if you want to understand what is wrong with GDP, then go onto YouTube, type in Robert Kennedy GDP, and you'll get a 2-minute speech he made in 1968, which was a speech he gave which probably defined what he would have done if he had become president of the US. Kennedy was, of course, assassinated shortly after, but he looked like to be the next president of the States, and it's a beautiful speech on what is wrong with GDP. And perhaps later, if we've got time, I'll show it. Otherwise, it's on YouTube. Barack Obama has seen that speech. He said it was one of his favorite pieces of political speeches ever. He used the word progress a lot in his campaign. He talked about the need for new measures of progress in the US. And I think in part this has come from the financial crisis. This was important before that, but the crisis has been a wake-up call to Western society and perhaps to the world, that people had this system, GDP was rising, you know, this is what was happening, and now people's faith in that has been shaken. People have lost their houses, they've lost their jobs, they've lost their pensions, and people are really wondering where have we gone wrong? What's happened? And I don't know if this happens in Thailand, but in the West there's a concept of a midlife crisis. It's something that often happens to men, mainly to men, in their 40s and 50s. They wake up one day and they say, what's my life been for? I've spent all this time working and doing all this and I'm not very happy. So these men go off and they get an earring and a tattoo and a sports car, right? So perhaps we need something similar. Not quite like that for the West, but it's very similar. You know, we've spent the last 60 years following this thing called GDP. We've been rushing around, building things, making things, and yet societies aren't any happier. In fact, in some ways they're unhappy. We don't trust each other as much. We don't talk to each other as much. We spend much more time working and much less time with our families. So something's gone wrong. So we're at a crisis point. And measuring progress can help this. It can help redefine progress and development. This is particularly important, I think, for a country that's developing. There's a real chance here to think about the future you want, which is what they're doing in Bhutan, to really think carefully so all the countries in the world don't just become another France or another Australia or another US. Each country's got to think where we're going and why we're going there. It can help each society protect the things that matter. It can help us to reach agreement on the ends we want to achieve as a society, perhaps in the form of an economic and social plan, because often we spend a lot of time discussing the policies we want, whether we should raise inflation, raise interest rates or cut interest rates, increase public spending, cut public spending. We talk about these policies and the political means, but we don't have a conversation about the ends. Where do we actually want to be as a society in 10, in 20 years? And measures of progress can also promote accountability, and they can help with the political economy of reform. That's the need. It's not just to design policies, but to get them working and to make citizens understand them, sell them to citizens. A challenge for governments today. A set of progress measures, when I talk about them, it could be an index, it could be just one number, but it's really underpinned by a set of economic, social, and environmental measures that discuss where a country like Thailand is coming from, where it was 10 years ago, where it is now, and also looking to the future, where it's heading. Is it sustainable? It's going to talk about the links between those aspects, not just present the economy somehow separate to society, somehow isolated from the environment. You talk about them together and you explain the way they link to one another. And then talk about whether progress is balanced, where there are things to be really proud about in Thailand and where there are things to be concerned about. And it's a conversation that's really important for a rapidly developing country, because things are changing so quickly somewhere like here. In 5 or 10 years, if you're thinking about the wrong things, people may wake up and they may say, well, GDP has risen in Thailand and we've done really well with tackling infant mortality, but somehow we've lost something as a society. What's happened to the trust we used to have? What's happened to our families? If you're not measuring the right things, you may lose them before you even notice, because things are changing so fast. So these are some of the reasons why the OECD began this global project. The aim of the global project is to encourage and help societies to develop their own sets of economic, social, environmental indicators. We aren't trying to design one set for the world. We're trying to encourage each society to come up with their own set. There's a very big movement around the world working on this, and this is the first attempt really to try and bring this movement together and to help coordinate it, because a lot of work's being done but people aren't talking as much as they should do. As you can see, it is a big movement. It comes out of government, academia, people like the Davos, the World Economic Forum are involved. There's international agencies, there's small grassroots organizations. It's happening in every continent. And we're looking at three main streams of work. First of all, what to measure. How do you think about something like progress? How do you begin to understand what it looks like and how to get the indicators for it? Once you know what that looks like, how do you actually measure it? How do you come up with the right statistics to measure some of these new areas like happiness and life satisfaction? And then third, crucially, how do you get those statistics used? There is no point whatsoever in producing the best index in the world of progress in Thailand, and if then no one sees it, if the citizens don't use it, if policymakers don't see it, then what was the point? So the third strand is trying to get these measures used, mainly by using new ICT tools. We're building a partnership at national, international, and local level with various levels of membership of the project. We're running a lot of events around the world, the biggest of which will be in October this year, which is the Third World Forum. It follows on from the Second World Forum in Turkey that Hans mentioned when he introduced me. What are we doing? In concrete terms, we're working on a handbook for progress. We're looking at a framework for progress, which I'll discuss in a second. Quality frameworks for indicator sets, lessons about successful indicators, training courses, and so on. The next conference is in Korea, in Busan, in October. We hope to have 1,500 people from over 130 countries attending. Professor Stiglitz will be there, along with politicians, civil society heads, academics, and so on. And there are three main topics for this. First topic, how is the world progressing? What are the challenges for the different regions of the world? Second, what are these new paradigms, these new thinking ways to think about progress mean for policymakers? It's opening up different ways to think about policy. Instead of just thinking about growing the economy, thinking about well-being is leading to different conversations. That's really changing the way some policy is made in some countries. Third question is, it's not enough to have evidence. We know evidence on its own doesn't lead to change. The world has known for a long time, really, what's happening with the climate. We know we are destroying our atmosphere. We know temperatures are rising. We know there's all sorts of problems coming. But people haven't, we still aren't really dealing with it as a planet. Why? What is it that goes on in people's minds? There's lots of psychological theory about this, sociological theory. So we want to bring together the sociologists and the psychologists with the political scientists and the statisticians to try and understand how evidence actually makes a change and how it can be ignored. And then lastly, which isn't so much a question for the conference but a thing to think about at the end, what institutions do we need as a world to take this forward? If this really is a new paradigm, if this thinking beyond national accounts to think about well-being is something that's important, then what do we need to do as a world differently to try and make this happen? The philosophy of the project, as I've said, but I can't say often enough, is there's the what to measure and the how to measure question. The how to measure, the statistical questions, okay, that's a technical question that we can help with at the OECD by developing best practice. But the what to measure, the what is progress, that's a political question. It's not for the OECD, it's not for the UN, it's not for anyone to tell a society like Thailand what progress is. That can only come from the Thai people. It's a very important conversation, I think, to have as a society. It's a very useful conversation. It can lead to all sorts of different discussions and relationships between people. But it's not for me to tell you people what progress means for Thailand. Everyone in this room will have a view about what progress means for them as an individual and for their country. And I think one of the real benefits of having a new index of progress here is to get a cross-section of people involved discussing this for themselves about where they want Thailand to head, what their values are, what they think is important, what they want to change. It's a very, very valuable conversation, even if it doesn't end up in an index. What can we do to help? Well, we can offer advice on best practices, how to have that conversation, how to measure this thing called progress or well-being. Once you've got it, once you have it, we can provide training courses, we can assist with a round table, we can help run events. There are many things to do, and I know I'll be talking to some of you at lunch about this, but we are very ready to help. So the first practical thing I think to think about is, once you've assembled your group of people who are going to talk about what progress is for Thailand, the first thing we tend to do, especially if like me, you're a statistician or an economist, is you think about having a framework, some model of the world in which you can work to try and make this manageable, so we can actually discuss what frameworks is. And frameworks, they can help with a conversation sometimes. Sometimes they look like this, and I don't think they help much at all. And the experience we had in Australia was, we spent a lot of time thinking about a framework to measure Australia's progress. And I have to say, in the end, after about 6 months of argument, we gave up. We just went and did it without a framework. And at the very end, we put a framework back on what we'd got. So there are ways around this. But some of the discussions we've had, which I think you're having here, which you will have, are what view of the world, what sort of paradigm do you take as yours? Now, if you're an environmentalist, if you're an economist, this is what happened in Australia, you might see the economy as being what's really important. That's what supports everything else. Do a big circle here. Economy. Economy kind of gives the money for society to survive. The environment is really a part of the economy. If you think in very broad terms, you can value everything. So this is an economist's view of the world. If you're someone who's more caring about social issues, then you see society is what's important for well-being in Thailand. It's society that matters. It's people. The economy is built by people in society, and the environment is there to serve society. So that might be your view of the world. Of course, if you're an environmentalist, then you're going to argue, without an environment, there won't be any life on this planet. So the environment's what matters. Within that, we have society that's living off the environment, and society builds its economy. So we had a similar conversation in Australia. We ended up with this sort of picture, a Venn diagram. But we decided, we had economy, society, environment, three circles. We put it up, and people said, that's just a Mickey Mouse picture. It doesn't mean anything. It's useless. Forget it. Go off and start again. So we gave up. After several more years thinking, this is the framework we've come up with now at the OECD with the Global Project. It was based on the work of a Canadian. It's also very, very similar to the work that Professor Stiglitz and his colleagues have come up with almost independently from the commission he's been running in France. And that's a commission that features 6 Nobel Prize winners, many, many other very clever people. And almost independently, they've got something pretty similar. So I think, begin to think this might be quite good. What we have here is 2 systems. A human system and an ecosystem, and they're linked together. The human system talks about 2 kinds of well-being. This is what really, really matters for society. There's the well-being that is within inside each individual. So our happiness, our mental health, our physical health, our material income. Our income is important for sure. Things like that. Then there's also the social well-being, which is really the well-being that's made up of the way we relate to other people. So we might have well-being as an individual, but also the quality of our relationships with our family, our friends, our colleagues, the amount we communicate, the amount we participate in society, in the electoral process, and so on. This is all part of well-being as well for people. Human well-being, that big blue circle, is supported by 3 things that we do as people to provide well-being. We build ourselves an economy, and it's not important in itself. It's important because it brings human well-being. We have a culture, food and language and religion and so on, and all that as well is important because it leads to well-being. And we have governance. We organize our society in a certain way to try and promote well-being. So these 3 black shapes, half circles, are things that aren't important in their own right. They're only important because they lead to human well-being. On the other side, we have the ecosystem, which is crucially important because without it, we wouldn't be here. It's linked to the human system through this thing called resource demand and through ecosystem services. It's just scientific speak for ecosystem services, the things the environment does for us that's good, provides clean water, fresh air, biodiversity, and so on. And resource demand is really the amount of pollution we throw back into the environment and the amount of stuff we take out of the environment, the amount of fish we take from the rivers and the sea, the amount of trees we chop down. And those 2 arrows really govern the way our system interacts with the ecosystem. Now, this isn't meant to be a final framework for progress. It's not the end result, but what we think it is a starting point. So if you sit down with a group of people in a society and you want to talk about progress, then perhaps you can start with this picture and see if it works, and if it does, then start adjusting it for your own needs, for the needs of Thailand. Because when we look around the world at what they've done in Bhutan, Canada, the UK, most things kind of fit back to this. It does cover potentially most of the things that most societies seem to think are important. So it can at least help you not have those conversations about which circle is the biggest and then be accused of doing a Mickey Mouse job. I've talked about this, I won't talk about it again, just the human well-being, the things it measures, culture, our governance and our economy, and then the ecosystem, what we measure there to try and assess the health of the environment. What I will say is that this goes beyond just those circles. You can use this framework to think about progress in different ways. First of all, progress is about change over time. So for any one of those areas, you should be looking at where Thailand is now as a society, looking back a certain number of years to see how things have changed, but also thinking forward. You can't predict the future exactly, but you can talk about whether it's sustainable. What might happen if we keep going in this direction for another 10, 20 years' time? Are we storing up trouble for ourselves? You need to think about distribution as well. It's not enough just to think about the average, for sure. It's very important to think about the equity in society, the amount of balance, what's happening between the rural and urban areas and so on. So within each of those areas, you can think about the distribution between whichever groups of people you like, between the old and the young, between men and women, between villagers and city people. So really there are two things to think about: distributions both over time and within a generation, within groups. There are also certain aspects of progress that aren't mentioned in that framework. Things like happiness, things like poverty, things like vulnerability, which is a word we're hearing a lot now. Where are they? Well, they don't fit exactly, because they're things that cut across many of the areas I've spoken about. You can be poor not just in terms of the money you have in the bank, but you can be poor in terms of your relationships with other people, with your health, with your education. And subjective well-being, happiness, again, that's not a single aspect. You don't just measure someone's happiness now. You measure how happy they feel about their work, about their health, about their relationships. So these sorts of areas cut across many of the dimensions in the framework. They're cross-cutting. So there's a place for those, but it's important to consider them elsewhere and bring together some of the information from the different parts of the framework, from the different dimensions of progress, and then you can talk about poverty in a much more meaningful and broad sense, or you can talk about subjective well-being. Subjective well-being is an area that I find increasingly interesting the more I listen to experts talk about this. It's really talking about the way we feel as people and how that is very, very important for our well-being. It's also quite a new area scientifically. It's not been around. It doesn't have the long tradition that other sciences have. It's also quite a controversial area, especially with statisticians. Many of them hate this. They think you can't measure it. It's meaningless. They can criticize it. They will criticize it a lot. I'll just talk a little bit about the way I see this has a place in any set of progress measures or any progress index. Objective measures. Now, we say objective, and I was at a talk last week by a professor from Canada who was saying he doesn't like this word objective because you use it to imply we measure this stuff exactly, it's accurate. But of course, most objective statistics are not objective at all. There's errors in them because of the way that they're constructed. So let's use these terms objective and subjective in a loose sense. But objective stuff is the things in life we think at least we can measure exactly. So you can count up the number of days someone lives, and that's their life until they die. That's their life expectancy. You can get a tape measure and measure how high someone is. Some scales, you can measure their weight. You can go to the bank and count up all the BART in their bank account. So there are objective ways to measure things like income and health and education and so on. The subjective components, these are things like fear, how scared we are, trust, happiness, how satisfied we are with life. there's a much, you can't get a machine to measure these. You can't get out a tape measure and see how happy someone is. You have to ask people. And that's why statisticians don't like this. You have to ask people how they feel, and it's quite difficult sometimes to do this. It's something we're still learning to do. That said, there are things we ask people about already that we've been doing for a long time that statisticians are quite happy doing. Business confidence is an important measure, at least in the West, about how confident people are in what the economy will do. That's a subjective measure. But it's certainly now seen as a very accurate measure of the economy, what might happen. It's a predicting measure. Self-assessed health status. You can take someone to a hospital. You can give them all sorts of tests. You can get them to see every doctor. But you can just ask them how they feel. And many, often that's just as good a predictor of their overall health than giving them a big range of scientific tests, and much, much easier to do. So there are subjective measures we use at the moment. Subjective and objective measures, I think, need to be considered side by side. When you start the index here, it's important to have a space for both of these. Certainly you can be very pleased as a society if things objectively are going very well. If you can say, you know, we've measured these things with our tape measures and our calculators, we know they're going well, but we've spoken to the people of Thailand as well, and they're happy, then you've got, that's real well-being. That's great. I mean, you'd be happy about that. If things are going very badly here and people feel very miserable about their lives, then you're in the bottom right-hand corner in a society that's deprived. So there's a big problem to be fixed. Perhaps more interesting, if you're a policymaker, is when you've got, you know, when you've got the opposite things happening in the different sides, the quadrant on the bottom left and the top right, where you've got a society where things are actually going very well objectively, but people aren't very happy. So there's a problem of perception. Why aren't people happy? Or you've got a society where people say they feel very happy, but if you look at all the figures, things are not very good at all. So people have kind of got used, they're putting up with a life they shouldn't. So that's a very interesting, I think those two corners are very interesting if you're a policymaker to try and tackle that. Subjective measures are very, very important measures for some areas of policy, probably more important than objective measures. Look at crime. The fear of what governs people, citizens' behavior when it comes to crime? Is it the official crime rates, or is it what they think crime is likely? What stops them wanting to leave their house at night and go for a walk? Is it because they've read in the paper that crime figures have dropped or gone up? Or is it because they actually have talked to people and they actually feel afraid? It's what they feel that matters. Same as trusting government. It's a key challenge for many governments is whether they're trusted or not. It matters the way they can develop policies and implement policies. Now, you can have all the measures you like of how honest and transparent a government is, but if they're not trusted by people in their hearts, then they're going to have a big problem. So some subjective measures are really crucial. And perhaps by presenting objective and subjective measures together in some sort of development index, you can actually influence the way people think by giving them the facts. You can then influence their subjective opinion. But the subjective often is what really counts. I was talking about this just before, but there's an increasing evidence now that people's position in society is a lot more, or is as important, if not more important, on their well-being than their overall level of what the economists would call utility. So as GDP goes up, the economists have always believed that the more money we have, the more utility, happiness, that's what the economists call it, we have, the better everyone is. But we're now discovering that isn't the case. After you reach a certain level of income, which isn't a huge amount, after that, most increases in happiness and well-being from money come because if your position in society changes. So if you get given 10,000 baht tomorrow, you feel happier. If you get given 10,000 baht, but everyone else in the room gets given 20,000, you feel more miserable than you did before, even though the economists say you should feel 10,000 baht happier. We've seen this. There's some very interesting work being done around beyond just money, beyond with things like unemployment. If you need to be unemployed, you're going to be happier being unemployed in a community where there's lots of other unemployed people. You feel much worse if you're unemployed and everyone around you has got jobs. There was just an interesting story. If you're an economist, you'll find this interesting. When people, I don't know what it's like in Thailand, but often there's an expression in the UK or in the USA called keeping up with the Joneses. It means trying to keep up with the people who live next door. And it's very difficult to prove that this actually influences people's behavior. But in Holland, they have a postcode lottery. So you buy a ticket. Everyone in Holland can buy a ticket for the lottery. And if you're, and they decide the winners by looking at where people live, their postcode, their zip code, right? And they pick a zip code from the computer. Everyone who lives in that area who had a lottery ticket wins. If you didn't have a ticket, it's tough. And they give a prize. They were giving BMW cars as a prize quite recently. And they look what happened, a car buying behavior in those postcodes, which won. And sales of new cars grew very steeply in postcodes that had won the postcode lottery. So some people, lots of people, they should have declined, really, because people were given, lots of people who won were given a new car. But for those people who didn't win, they were going out to buy new cars as well because they saw these shiny BMWs in their neighbours, outside their neighbours' houses. So that's very interesting, sort of clear evidence that this relational stuff is important. So it's really, it's a new thing for policymakers to think about. We need to think about the equity and the way we distribute resources and money and solutions across society, because that matters to people. Why include subjective well-being and think about this? Well, I very much like the way the Bhutanese Prime Minister talks about this as a way to organize an index of progress for Bhutan. He says, you know, the thing that all the Bhutanese people want, and it goes for everyone in the world, is they want to be happy. So we think about the things that determine happiness and we try and measure those. Now, that's happiness in a very broad sense. It's not just whether you're smiling and laughing that morning. It's about spiritual well-being. It's about culture. It's about the environment. But as a way to organize our thinking, I think it's very nice. It's incredibly popular among the public. Everyone likes to read about this stuff. It's very, very interesting. There's a whole explosion in the science about this. They're giving out Nobel Prizes for this now. It's important. And there's also very solid evidence that the way we feel about ourselves and our lives are important for the more objective measures we traditionally use. And seeing as we're talking about health a lot here today, perhaps you haven't heard the story about the nuns in the United States. This is another sort of interesting, sort of slightly geeky economist statistical story. But one of the problems with looking at how things like happiness affects health is it's very, very difficult to measure scientifically, because of all the different other things that would affect health as well, which may also be affected or affect happiness. It's a very complicated story. So we can't take people out and put them in a laboratory and give them a different level of income or a different diet. We can do that with mice or monkeys, perhaps. We can't do it with people. So it's very, very difficult to understand. You know, maybe happiness, if someone's happy, they go out, they work harder, they get more income. Maybe that more income leads to more health. Or maybe the more income leads to more happiness, but it's the income that's driving health. Very, very difficult to prove scientifically, but someone in the US had the good idea of looking at nuns, groups of people who live very similar lives. They wake up at the same time, they have the same diet, they have the same income. I guess most of them don't have any income, but they live together. So it's almost like a laboratory experiment. They looked at a group of nuns who became nuns in the 1930s and 1940s in the United States, in Milwaukee. One particular group who lived together. And what they did was they looked back in time, and they looked back to try and work out how happy they were when they became nuns. And when you became a nun, in those days at least, you had to write a letter of application. And they looked at those letters and they rated them on a scale of 1, 2, and 3. Happy nuns were those women who wrote in saying, you know, my heart is full of joy for God, I want to do good things, I want to become a nun to make the world a better place. That was given a box 1. A miserable woman was a box 3, who might write saying, I've been a terrible sinner all my life, I've done awful things, I have to make peace with God, I have to serve the church, I want to become a nun. So they were seen as quite miserable people when they joined. They then followed those people throughout their lives and saw when they died. What they found was that the happy nuns, the happy women, they were living about 9 or 10 years longer on average, and it's a big sample, than those who are miserable. Now, 9 or 10 years, as anyone who's familiar with health, is a huge difference in life expectancy. It's, I don't know what it, in Thailand, I imagine it might have been, you might have seen that sort of gain the last 40 or 50 years of development, perhaps a bit less in somewhere like Thailand, but certainly somewhere like Australia, that's about 50 years worth of economic growth and development has led to that, and scientific breakthrough has led to that increase of life expectancy. So here's an example of where happiness really does seem to matter for something which we can all agree life expectancy is important. Why wouldn't you include it? Subjective well-being, well, it's very difficult to measure. It doesn't mean it can't be measured, it just means we're still working as science, the science, to develop new ways to measure it. Politicians might say it's very difficult to see why it's policy relevant to measure things like life satisfaction. We can't just announce the Prime Minister's not going to get up tomorrow and say his new policy is to make everyone happy and that's it. But you can look certainly at other aspects of life and look at it in pieces. How can we make people happier with their employment, with their education, and so on? So I think it is policy relevant. It doesn't seem to change much over time. Now, there are many scientific reasons for this. I just think it's because we haven't got the right measures. But what we do know is it does change during the life, people's life course. There's a U-shaped effect for happiness. So it tends to be quite high. When we're younger, when we have kids, it actually gets a bit low. It drops down for most people when they have young children, probably because of they're not sleeping and it's so busy and difficult. And then it goes up again as we get older. But that's a fairly common effect across most societies. So it does change. The business about changing over time, I think, is really the way we construct the measures. I just think we need to be a bit clever about coming up with new measures. And lastly, if you talk to many statisticians, they will say this isn't appropriate ground for a National Statistical Office. Let's leave this to the academics and so on. But again, that's changing. We're running a workshop at a conference this week, about this, trying to encourage statistics officers to see that they really need to get involved in this, because if they don't, someone else will be doing this for them, and it's about relevance and so on. Progress towards what? This is another question I think you'll need to ask yourselves in this country when you work on your index. What are you trying to measure progress towards? Are you going to have some sort of goals, like the MDGs, but a Thailand-developed equivalent, and track performance towards those goals? Are you simply going to pick the aspects of life in Thailand that you think are important and see whether they're getting better or worse over time? Are you going to rank individuals or regions of provinces of Thailand or Thailand compared to other countries in ASEAN or the world? These are all different ways to think about measuring progress. And what you decide, I think, will be very important, because they can all foster progress in different ways, and it depends on who's running it. You can't start setting goals or targets unless you've got the politicians involved. The statistics office can't do that. Ranking is important, but again, there can be problems with that. It can become controversial. So there's different things to think about, and all of them are important. Finally, why do we think this is so important in the global project? Well, there are benefits for citizens. There are benefits for policymakers, and there are benefits for countries and societies themselves. For citizens, it can certainly enhance citizen engagement, and it can promote really accountability at a local level. So one of the changes we're seeing in the West is that life is becoming a lot more complex for people. People are being given more freedom of choice. They're allowed now to select the schools they send their children to. They select their own pension funds. They choose which doctor and which hospital to see. But with that freedom of choice becomes a lot more complexity. How, as a parent, do you decide which school you want to send your child to? You're given lots of information, but it's very, very difficult. So people have school league tables. They rank all the schools in a neighborhood. Again, it can be quite controversial. But doing this measuring progress at the local level or at the national level can really enhance citizen engagement in different processes. For policymakers, it can lead policymakers in different departments to have a much broader view of why their department or their work is important. The work of education, the education department, goes well beyond just getting children and students through school and university. It can lead to better health. It can lead to better engagement, better democracy, and so on. All these areas, these departments link up, and it can really help policymakers think in terms of the bigger picture, and it can promote more whole of government, more joined up government approaches. So you don't have departments competing quite as much. You don't have a forest department trying to chop down the trees which the environment department is trying to protect. You can get people thinking more. It can also give politicians the data they need for a society to try and sell some of the difficult policies they need to sell to citizens. If they can say, look at the indicators or look at the index, it's going down. We need to do something about greenhouse emissions. We need to do something about education, then it can help sell those policies, because often or always there is a cost to any difficult policy. So it involves money being spent that could be spent elsewhere. For societies, it can really help with accountability. a US Supreme Court justice from quite a long time ago said sunshine is the best disinfectant. By putting out trusted indicators about what's happening within a government, that will promote accountability, perhaps better than it is sometimes, so it can fight corruption, can shift resources around. So progress measures help with this accountability, with public debate, with resource prioritization. They can enhance democracy. If you enhance democracy, you will get better decisions. And if you can get better decisions, then that will generate progress. So by measuring progress, you can generate progress. And just a final comment for anyone who's thinking about the statistics in this. These statistics in a progress index are the things that are, you know, they're just, there are these stories of a society. There are stories of human tragedy. They're stories of joy, of failure, of people dying, of people being born. And all these statistics we're talking about, they're not statistics, they're people. Maybe they're people with the tears washed away, as this sociologist said, but we're really talking about the very fabric, the DNA codes of our society, the things that matter. So, thank you.